Oil futures hit a new milestone yesterday, almost $140 a barrel before falling back to $133. Is there anything our government can do to lower the cost of oil and the skyrocketing price of gas at the pump? Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, June the 17th. Politicians are debating ways to ease our pain at the pump. The other day, Vice President Dick Cheney blamed Democrats in general for not doing enough because of their opposition to drilling for oil in the Anwar Wildlife Refuge. Critics say that the environmental risks are far too high for that. Yesterday, John McCain called for an end to the ban on offshore drilling to get more oil production going in this country. Barack Obama opposes an end to that ban, saying that the plan to simply drill our way out of our energy crisis is the same misguided approach backed by President Bush that has failed our families for too long and only serves to benefit the big oil companies. So who's right? Should we be producing more oil domestically to help lower gas prices? Is drilling for more oil in this country an answer, at least in the short term, or not? Our guest says yes, and we'll wonder what you think. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Jerry Taylor, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So first, let's talk a little bit, since this is in the news this morning, that yesterday John McCain called for an end to the ban on offshore drilling. You would agree with that?
Well, I would. A vast amount of oil and gas is locked up in these lands that are off limits to the oil and gas industry. These lands are off California, they're off the Atlantic coast, then the Gulf of Mexico. If we were to allow the oil companies to go there and get that oil and gas, we could probably add maybe a couple million barrels a day in U.S. Oil production over time. And that would be a significant amount of oil in the market. That's about what Kuwait puts into the market on a daily basis. So I think it's a good idea, particularly since prices are very high right now, and the only way to bring them down is to either increase supply or reduce demand. And the Congress has very limited ability to do either. This is one of the very few things they could do to help bring prices down.
Yeah. Then what do you say about Barack Obama, who says that we can't drill our way out of this? This only serves to benefit the big oil companies.
Well, you know, that rhetoric's fairly common amongst the political class, but they're of two minds on that subject. They seem to think OPEC can drill our way out of this. I mean, every Democrat that I've seen, and a lot of Republicans, think that the president's job is to continually shuttle over to the Middle East and inveigh upon OPEC oil producers to produce more oil. Well, what's that if not drilling our way out of the problem? If high gasoline and oil prices are a problem, and most Americans think it is, and the objective is to lower gasoline prices and oil prices, then again, there's only two ways to do it. You can either increase supply in the market, or you can reduce the demand for that product in the market. Preferably, you'd want to try to effectuate both.
Yeah, I thought that we were reducing our demand in the market, at least in this country, yet we're paying more and more at the pump.
Well, we are. Demand is down in the United States, but it's up around the world. The reason for that is that there are no price controls in the United States. American motorists and American businesses are paying full market prices for oil and gas, as they should, and that provides a signal for people to conserve, and conserve they are. We're finding reading the business papers on any given day, you'll find evidence, on almost a daily basis that the American consumer is turning away from big SUVs and minivans. They're buying more subcompacts, fuel-efficient cars. They're reducing the amount of driving they do. They're consolidating errands and trips to the grocery store and whatnot, and that's reducing demand, and that's a positive thing. But the problem is that over half of the world today is not paying market prices for gasoline. They're paying government-dictated prices that's shielding them from market signals that might induce them to conserve, and government taxpayers in China and India and elsewhere are paying the balance. So those price controls abroad are frustrating demand response in the global oil market. Now, this probably can't continue forever. India, Vietnam, Malaysia, other countries are beginning to peel away these price protections for consumers. And that's causing, of course, a great deal of angst abroad, but it's a necessary prerequisite if we're going to have conservation. You know, the interesting thing is that Americans, like everyone else, seem to be of two minds about this. If you ask your average person, do we need more conservation, they'll say sure. Ask the average person if we need lower prices, they'll say sure. Well, the two don't go together. You're not going to get conservation when prices are low, or especially when prices are being artificially dampened by government. So American consumers are responding. They'll respond more over time as the auto fleet turns over. That's the main reason, way that people do conserve energy. But I think we need to wait for the rest of the world to catch up to American policy, and slowly it's doing that.
Yeah, well, the offshore drilling issue is one thing, and then there's the drilling in Alaska. What do you say about the opponents who say that the environmental risks are too high for this and the payoff too low?
Well, you know, these are subjective matters. I'm not sure what people mean when they say the environmental risks are too high. What are the risks in play?
The pristine environmental area that shouldn't be disrupted.
Sure. I mean, there are a lot of people put a great value on wilderness protection, and that's fine. We do have a reference case to examine here, however. America's been drilling oil out of Prudhoe Bay, Alaska, for decades now. And the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is not substantially different from Prudhoe Bay. So what's happened in Prudhoe Bay? Well, we find the caribou herds have grown, not shrunk. Polar bear populations have gone up, not down. There doesn't seem to be any negative environmental consequence that we can quantify in Prudhoe Bay, so it's hard to understand why that might be the case in Alaska. The industry thinks that they can put about 800,000 barrels a day into the market once that field is mature, and they would be using a swath of land only about half the size of Dulles National Airport. So we're not talking about putting drilling rigs, you know, all through northern Alaska. We're talking about a very, very small footprint on this wilderness area. And I think that probably makes sense.
We're talking with Jerry Taylor, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, who supports efforts to drill for more oil in the United States to help reduce the high price of gas at the pump. What do you say? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 18 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, June the 17th. We are wondering this hour if the answer to lower gas prices is more oil drilling here at home. Our guest says yes, in part. Jerry Taylor, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and our first caller is Steve in Hudson. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
The same old tired answers for high gas prices, more drilling. You know, we're at a point where we're already seeing effects of climate change from the carbon that we put in the air to this point. In Iowa, and I'm not sure if southern Wisconsin actually fits into the category, but they've had their second 500-year flood in the last 15 years. And we've had other extreme weather events that may or may not be related to climate change, but it's what we apparently have to look forward to. The idea that we should be taking more oil out of the ground and putting more carbon into the air is just insanity. The technology exists to start going the other way. A few years back, General Motors had an all-electric car in the marketplace, and by many accounts of the people who drove them, they were great. And what was the response by General Motors? They crushed the cars instead of doing whatever to make it a more permanent fixture. More drilling is not the answer, besides the fact that the Arctic National Reserve or any of these places, it's going to be years before any of that oil gets to the market. And once it does, with the current system we have, there's no guarantee that it's even going to be kept in the United States and do anything to lower prices.
All right. What do you say, Jerry Taylor? We should be going in the other direction toward renewable fuels and production of those types of cars and not drilling for more oil.
Well, the fact is that if we keep the market starved of light crude oil, conventional oils, as the caller thinks we ought to. The alternative may not be renewable energy. It may be dirtier fuels. In fact, that's a major concern with environmentalists, that oil has been losing market share because of price, but you know what's been gaining market share is coal. And coal is an even dirtier fuel from a climate perspective and from the perspective of conventional pollutants. When we talk about electric cars, we sometimes talk as if the electricity comes from the thin blue sky, and it doesn't. It comes from coal-fired power plants for the most part in this country. And it's not clear that a shift from oil in the transportation market to electricity would, on balance, help instead of hurt the global environment. As far as GM is concerned, yeah, they gave up the EV1 about 10 years ago because gasoline prices were at their lowest inflation-adjusted level in history. So it just didn't make a lot of economic sense to drive an EV1, and they didn't think they had much of a market for it. But today, the caller may be happy to learn that the Chevy Volt is coming online in the next couple of years. You're going to see that in the marketplace, and that's the EV1 on steroids. And that's not the only company that's promoting an all-electric vehicle. There are dozens of them that are coming into the market, some very high-end, like Tesla Motors is manufacturing a $100,000 all-electric car, great performance car, but really expensive. And the reason for that is it's kind of expensive to run an all-electric car. But there are some cheaper models that are going to be available, like the Volt, and so consumers will have that choice. But from a greenhouse perspective, if you ask the question, well, if we're not going to use oil, what are we going to use? Sometimes you hear solar power, renewable and wind power. Geothermal, none of those things are going to move a car. What's going to move a car is maybe biofuels and, of course, electricity. And it turns out that biofuels are even a worse greenhouse gas problem than is conventional oil. Again, on the electricity grid, wind and solar simply can't compete with coal at all. And if it weren't for the subsidies, preferences, and tax credits, that energy source would completely disappear. It's that uncompetitive, and you don't need to take my word for it. The trade associations for renewable energy industry are constantly on Capitol Hill saying you have to renew the tax credits and subsidies or else we go away. So that tells you how economically uncompetitive this stuff is at the moment. Now, it may not always be. You know, maybe in a bright and shiny future, we'll have low environmental impact by cellulosic ethanol to rely on, and maybe the economics of solar power will radically improve. All these things are very possible. But right now, they're not very realistic alternatives to oil.
Yeah. What about his comment that any oil found in the Arctic is years away and may not even be used in this country?
Well, that's absolutely true. It turns out that not all of the oil that we produce in Alaska goes to American consumers. Some of it goes to Japan. Some of it goes to Korea. Not a majority of it, probably only about, I don't know what the latest numbers are, but it's somewhere around 5 or 10% is exported abroad. It's more profitable to do that than bring it to the United States. But that's somewhat irrelevant. It doesn't really matter where the oil goes. What matters when it comes to crude oil prices is global supply and global demand. So, for instance, to give you an example, the United States does not import any oil from Iran. We don't do any oil trade with Iran. But everyone understands that if Iran were to quit producing, it would increase oil prices here in the United States. Why? Well, because crude oil prices are established by global supply and demand patterns. So it really doesn't matter whether the oil in Alaska ends up in Japan or ends up in Northern California. As long as it's in the market, it's going to have the same price impact no matter where it goes. As far as the amount of time it'll take to get that oil into the market, that's absolutely correct. It takes 8 to 10 years from the time in which investments are made in a new field to the time in which that new field is producing substantial amounts of crude oil for the global market. And there's no way to short-circuit that amount of time. It's just a very lengthy and expensive process. Tens of billions of dollars go into the infrastructure. And it can't be done overnight. If that were an argument against extracting oil, then we wouldn't have any oil in the economy at all. That's just a fact, which is all the more reason for getting some of these fields online now as opposed to waiting, because there is going to be a wait period.
Thanks, Steve. Bill in Deerfield is next. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Well, since 2001, we've had an increase in oil leases on public land by several 100%, and a lot of those leased lands are sitting idle right now, and it's pretty understandable why. It's to ExxonMobil's benefit to have a tight supply, because the demand is constant pretty much and the price goes up. So instead of drilling in Alaska or instead of getting new leases offshore, why don't the oil companies just go ahead and start drilling on the leases that they already have? And if they don't, I suggest that Barack Obama, when he's president, say, well, you've got 60 days to option these leases, take effect of them, or we're just going to void them.
What's up with that, Jerry Taylor?
Well, it's certainly true that the oil industry has a number of leases that they're not taking advantage of on federal lands. The main reason for that is there's not a lot of oil in those leased lands. The oil tends to be in the areas where they can't go. It's not as if all leases are created economically equal. If there's an internal inconsistency of the argument. If you want to argue that the oil companies get federal leases and then don't use them because they want to strangle the market, then why would anybody worry about giving them leases in Alaska? Because presumably they would act the same way. Now, obviously, environmentalists don't think that if the oil industry had leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, they would leave them unexercised. The fear is, of course, they would exercise them. So the argument that the oil industry gets leases and they bury them to keep prices high would be good news for the environmental lobby, right? Because they don't want to see this extraction. But, of course, they're very nervous about providing leases in the Arctic or the offshore areas in the coastal area. So, you know, I think that's kind of a duplicity. This argument. It turns out that ExxonMobil, for instance, let's take them as an example, they produce all of 3% of the global oil market. In other words, ExxonMobil's production decisions are not able to have that much effect on the global crude oil market. National oil companies from abroad have a far bigger impact on oil supply. So ExxonMobil, if it can produce oil in the market today, is going to make money. In fact, extraction costs typically, at the margin right now in the oil business for conventional crudes are running about $18 or $20 a barrel. If you can produce that oil and sell it on a world market where the going price is $140, you do it. You don't do your bottom line any favor by leaving oil in the ground right now that's profitable to extract. And again, if it were otherwise, then there wouldn't be much of a debate here, right? We wouldn't be all that, or environmentalists wouldn't be all that concerned with allowing the industry access to Alaska and the coastal areas of the United States.
Let's go next to Dan in Milwaukee. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
I have a question regarding refining capacity. I think we all know that oil can't be directly put into cars, and the United States oil refining capacity is fairly topped out. With producing more oil, if we can't increase our refining capacity at the same time, how much gasoline can we really get out of the market to help reduce oil prices?
That's a good question. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about refining capacity. It turns out that it's more important what global refining capacity is, not so much what U.S. refining capacity is, because increasingly we have a global trade in refined oil products and gasoline and diesel fuel and jet fuel and that sort of things. Oil products are now shipped across oceans. That wasn't the case 10 years ago. So it's not so important what U.S. refining capacity is. What's important is what global oil refining capacity is. Now, if you talk to the industry, if they were unable to build new refining capacity because of regulatory red tape or because of environmental opposition or not in my backyard local activists, I'm sure they'd be the first to tell you. But if you talk to the industry, they don't have any complaints with any of those things. They say, look, we don't build new refining plants. What we do is we expand the capacity of existing refining plants because that's a lot cheaper to do. And it turns out that refining capacity has actually increased over the last several decades as the demand for refining has increased. And today, refining capacity is actually fairly high, and we're not using all of it. In fact, we're leaving a lot of it idle because there's no profit in refining. So there's no real tightness in the market. But there is a tightness in the heavy crudes refining business, and this is a little complicated, but it turns out that there are 130-odd grades of crude. Not all oil looks alike chemically, and it's not all equally useful for the market. But because the OECD nations, United States, Europe, and Japan, have regulations mandating low sulfur fuels for environmental reasons,
we just have 30 seconds before our news break.
It turns out it's very hard to use high sulfur crude for gasoline. The refineries that can do it are a little bit short, and so there is a question regarding the refining capacity for that oil. That's true.
Jerry Taylor, our guest, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, talking with us about why he says we should be drilling for more oil here in the U.S. We welcome your thoughts and questions on that after the news. This is the Ideas Network. It's 7:36. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along on this Tuesday, June the 17th. We're talking about whether or not drilling for more oil in this country, in Alaska, maybe offshore, is that the solution for high gas prices? Jerry Taylor, our guest, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, says it's certainly a part of the solution. We wonder what you think, what questions you have. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Last week, Vice President Dick Cheney challenged Congress to do more to help Americans who are feeling the pain at the pump. He says we need to be increasing domestic oil production, including in Alaska. Yesterday, John McCain, presidential candidate, said that the federal moratorium on offshore oil and gas drilling should be lifted. So we wonder what you think about that. This coming at a time when oil futures soaring to new levels, $140 a barrel yesterday before falling back to about $133. Our next caller is Marie in Milwaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I think finally Americans are conserving because of necessity, and that seems to be the only thing that changes behaviors of Americans. And if oil prices go down, they'll cease to conserve. And I think also innovation is driven by necessity in this country. I was told by a physicist that our photovoltaics are based on physics of 100 years ago, and they need more money for research. And in its history, oil has been subsidized. So I think the only way the change will happen is if we accept the situation as it is.
Mm-hmm. Jerry Taylor?
Well, the caller is absolutely right. High prices induce conservation. Low prices induce energy use. That's certainly axiomatic, and it's certainly true. And necessity is the motherhood of invention. But I think we oftentimes are blurring energy technologies. There may be a bright future with solar energy technology, given the advances in nanotechnology and biochemistry and other things like that, but it's unclear to what extent that's going to assist the transportation fleet. And unless you're going to swathe your car in solar panels, it isn't going to go anywhere on solar energy. It could, of course, be a source of electricity for a battery, but right now battery technology is so expensive and has so many performance issues that nobody in the marketplace, in the auto industry, either in the United States or abroad, thinks that all battery vehicles are a reasonable replacement for conventional gasoline-powered engines, at least for the time being. Now, that might change. And, of course, if you've got $100,000 in the next couple of years, you'll be able to buy a really nice all-electric vehicle sports car. And if you want to buy a Chevy Volt or something like that, they'll be on the market in the next couple of years, too. But those batteries are going to be run by coal-fired power plants for the most part, supplemented by natural gas and nuclear. And it's not clear that that's environmentally preferable. And it's certainly not clear that those are going to be cheaper engines. It turns out that, again, it's going to be more expensive to move your car a mile with those technologies after you look at the fuel costs and the capital cost of the vehicle than it is with gasoline-powered cars, even given high prices today.
Yeah. Well, maybe we still have to deal with that because, after all, it's not unlimited, the fossil fuels, right, Jerry Taylor? I mean, maybe we should do this now rather than later.
Well, if indeed we're running low on conventional oil and gasoline, the market prices will keep going up and no one will have to worry about conservation. It's going to occur endogenously. But it turns out there's a tremendous amount of unconventional crude out there that we haven't tapped yet, mostly because of price. For instance, we have three times more oil in the Rocky Mountain West wrapped up in shale rock than all the Saudis do in proved reserves right now. The reason we've never availed ourselves of that oil is it's very expensive to extract from the shale. Oil prices have to be around $90 a barrel over the entire lifetime of those investments in oil shale to allow investors to get any sort of return. Now, if oil prices remain high because we're running low on conventional crudes, that I think we're going to see an investment blitz on shale oil, and we're going to put a lot of unconventional crude oil into the market, and that's going to keep a lid on price over time. The problem from an environmental perspective is all this unconventional crude oil is very dirty. It's very greenhouse gas intensive. It's a much dirtier fuel for a whole host of reasons. And environmentally, it's not preferable. So to say, well, we should keep out of Alaska or off the coast of the United States because this is dirty fuel, well, the alternatives probably aren't going to be a lot of the renewable energies to move our auto fleet that we're talking about. The alternatives to this sort of oil is going to be much more environmentally problematic, unconventional crude oils. There's a lot of that stuff laying around. Price has been the main obstacle up to now, but if prices remain high, then those unconventional crudes are probably going to come into the market.
Next we go to Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, but I think everybody's looking around for the wrong thing. It's not the quantity, it's the fact that it's tied to the American dollar and it's traded around the world and the owners of the oil. in the dollar. And the dollar goes down, the price of oil goes up, because those people say our dollar isn't worth anything. When are we going to start doing something about the value of our dollar? It's the value of our dollar going down that's driving the prices up, not the shortage of oil.
Jerry Taylor?
Well, the value of the dollar has something to say about the price of crude oil, but it's not such a direct relationship as the caller suggests. The price, the increases in oil price, I mean, oil has increased by a factor of 5 or 6 since 2003. Oil has not, or excuse me, the dollar has not devalued to that extent. So this is not purely a dollar problem. If it were, then the oil price increase would be far less than they have been. And it's not as if producers, because, you know, let's back up. Oil is traded globally in dollars everywhere. Dollar is the currency of exchange for oil everywhere in the world today. So one might, you know, the caller suggests, well, the producers find that the dollars are less valuable than they used to be, so they have to ask for higher prices. They can ask for higher prices if they want. That doesn't mean you're going to get it. It turns out that producers are charging what the market will bear, period, and end of story, and they can't just arbitrarily declare, well, this isn't as profitable as it used to be, I'm going to increase prices by 20%, because you may not find buyers at that price. For instance, the Saudis announced a few days ago, or at least they intimated that they will be announcing a 500,000 barrel a day increase in oil production, and refineries in the United States shrugged their shoulders and said, good luck, we wouldn't buy it, it's too high a price. They're asking for too much, and we're not buying that kind of crude, and it's the kind of crude we don't need. So it's not entirely a dollar problem. The dollar does play into this in that it reduces the impact of oil price increases in Europe, because if you're a European driver, or if you're a procurer of fuel in Europe, you have to take your euros and buy dollars, and look what's happened. You can buy a lot more dollars of those euros today than you ever used to. So the price signals in Europe are not as dramatic as the price signals in the United States, which means that there's less of an incentive to conserve in Europe than there might be if the dollar were stronger. So there are impacts. The dollar does have an effect on oil prices, but I think frequently it's overstated.
We're talking about oil prices and gas prices and whether the government should do something to lower those prices for all of us. Maybe drilling for more oil in Alaska and elsewhere in the U.S. Our guest thinks that ought to happen, and we wonder what you think. Presidential candidate John McCain yesterday called for an end to the moratorium on offshore drilling in this country. Presidential candidate Barack Obama opposed lifting that moratorium. We'll welcome your calls or your thoughts on that specific issue as well as we continue. Should the U.S. lift the offshore oil drilling moratorium that's currently in place? Should we be drilling offshore to provide more oil for our cars and energy needs? Yes or no? Why or why not? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up after 8 o'clock, we will talk with a physician who traveled the world investigating native diets, and she has discovered the healthiest diets in the world. And we'll talk about them coming up after 8 o'clock. We're talking right now with Jerry Taylor, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, who says we should be drilling for more oil and trying to produce more oil in this country, like in Alaska and offshore. Welcoming your thoughts and questions for him. Milton in West Allis is with us now. Hi, Milton.
The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. If we depend on the government to lower prices, it'll never happen because our government is made of oilmen like George Bush and Dick Cheney. The guest says alternatives are uncompetitive. Uncompetitive with $140 a gallon, or rather a barrel oil? Okay, we have technologies like thermal D and repolymerization that can use any feedstock, including plastic bottles that are now going to the dump. The quickest thing that we can do to break the back of the oil companies is carpooling. Carpooling is easy. Carpooling works. Carpooling reduces traffic. You put just one more person in your car, you've reduced your cost 50%. And I'd really like to know why carpooling is being ignored so a super cheap alternative is being ignored so that we can put more money in the pockets of George Bush's and Dick Cheney's friends and families.
Jerry Taylor.
Well, a couple of questions here. As far as carpooling is concerned, it's not being ignored. People are carpooling. In the Washington area where I live, there's a very robust market for people to carpool. They're called slug lanes, and if you can get three people in your car, you can use the HOV lanes to get to work and shave about 45 minutes off your commute time. And the newspapers here have been full of stories about how these slug lanes, which is, you know, sort of ersatz, informal spot markets for carpooling, are booming in Washington. And I assume that this isn't a unique story to Washington. So carpooling is certainly an option, and people can do it if they want. I don't believe the government should force us to carpool. This isn't the Soviet Union. We can make our own decisions about how to get to work. If we want to pay higher prices and not carpool and have longer commutes, fine. If we want to save some money and get into a slug lane, or if we want to shave off commute times by availing ourselves of HOV lanes via carpooling, people will do that, and they do. As far as the profits for the oil companies are concerned, you know, I think there's a lot of huff and puff about this, but it turns out that about 5% of the price of crude oil goes into profits for the oil companies. Most of it doesn't. They make about a 5% profit on that crude. The government makes about a 14% profit via taxes. So if anybody is profiting off high prices, it's the federal government, federal, state, and local governments. It's not oil. They're much less profited by these by gasoline sales than is government at all levels. As far as the argument about putting more dollars in oil companies' pockets, it just turns out, look, you can't produce crude oil and expect to have a world in which nobody profits from that. If we're going to argue that, oh, you know, lower oil prices would be fine, I just don't want to make a buck on it, then we won't have crude oil, and we can content ourselves with $4, $5, $6, $7, $8 oil and a lot of carpooling. Most Americans, I don't think, want to see that kind of world. There is hardship associated with high price. It takes money out of our pockets that we might have used for something else, maybe for college savings, maybe for a vacation, maybe for a few nights out every month at dinner that we can no longer take. So I think there's a cavalier attitude about this. It's certainly true that we can let prices continue to rise and we can lift no finger whatsoever to increase supply, and people will adjust. People adjust in Europe. As far as the competition to oil is concerned, it's certainly true. We have a lot of technologies and a lot of fuels that can move a car from point A to point B, and there are a lot of ways to build an engine to use all kinds of things. It's just too expensive, which is why we don't do it. Europe, for instance, has gasoline prices in U.S.-denominated terms somewhere between $7 and $10 a gallon. Well, where's the competitors to oil? Nowhere to be seen. In the United States, we have, for instance, biofuels is the closest thing we have as a competitor to oil. And if you look at wholesale spot markets last week, you'll find that ethanol was selling at about $1 a gallon more than was oil, even with oil prices being as high as they are. And the main reason for that is that high energy prices affect the cost of producing ethanol just as much as they increase the price of producing anything. And ethanol is just very expensive to make. Now, I'd have no complaint if technologies improved and allow us to substitute something else for oil. It would probably be a very happy thing. But the government just can't wave a wand and make it happen just by wishing and blink, you know, clicking its heels three times and saying there's no place like home. Things like that don't work. Again, it's all well and good to talk about technological alternatives, and there are certainly plenty, as the caller mentioned, but it can't be done cheaply. At least it can't be done cheaper than a gallon of gasoline can do the job of moving your car. I wish it were otherwise, but that's just the way it is.
Thank you, Milton, for the call. An email now from Ben in Green Bay, who agrees we should start drilling in Alaska and offshore, but with a few requirements. He says we need to cut subsidies for oil companies, raise taxes on oil companies, create a carbon tax that gradually matches that in Europe, and invest the extra tax revenue in green energy and green energy technology. This, he says, would increase supply while at the same time increasing revenue and demand for clean energy. We only have less than 10 minutes, but in general, Jerry Taylor, what do you think of his approach?
Not much. If we increase taxes on oil companies, we're going to get less oil production. We know that for a fact, because we did it once. We had the windfall profits tax of 1980. It lasted 6 years, and a study by the Congressional Research Service found that by increasing taxes on domestic oil production, we reduced the incentives to invest in domestic oil production, which resulted in a 3 to 6% decline in domestic oil production. So you increase taxes on oil, you're going to get less oil. That's axiomatic, and there's no way around it. As far as the energy subsidies or the subsidies to the oil industry are concerned, they don't amount to a great deal. The industry doesn't fight for them very hard. When we talk about the things that are on the Hill right now, where the Democrats have gone after oil subsidies, I supported them because I don't believe in subsidizing anybody. Nuclear energy, renewable energy, oil, you know, we're libertarians at the Cato Institute. Mm-hmm. We believe in leaving markets unrigged. But it turns out that the subsidies aren't quite what they seem. The oil industry, for instance, the biggest subsidy they get is they get to take advantage of a provision in the tax code which provides a tax break for everybody in the manufacturing business in the United States. All manufacturers get this tax break. What the Democrats would like to do is to say all manufacturers except oil companies are going to get to take advantage of this tax break. Now, personally, I think that no manufacturer should get an artificial tax break. We shouldn't be rigging the market to favor investments in manufacturing versus investments in something else. So if we're going to go after subsidies, great, let's get rid of them for everybody. But to go ahead, go out and single out the oil companies and say, well, they don't get to take advantage of this, but renewable energy companies do and steel plants do and everyone else does, that's not so much as, it's not really going after oil subsidies per se. It's sort of going out of the way to take a stick to oil companies. And given the fact their profits are not anywhere near as dramatic as you might think, their operating profits are less than Fox News's. They don't make as much as most of the software companies in the United States. I think that's a counterproductive strategy.
We go now to Ray in Stratford. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joy. I agree with your guest in that I believe that we should be drilling for more oil in the United States. But one thing that he's not talked about in his discussions about oil in Alaska and alternatives to oil in the Rocky Mountains is a formation called the Bakken Formation in North Dakota. The numbers that I've read about that is that there's something like 16 billion barrels of oil available in Alaska, 125 billion barrels available in Iraq, and the Bakken Formation, the estimates range from 32 billion to 600 billion, with the North Dakota Geological Survey and the U.S. Geological Survey settling on about 400 billion barrels of available oil. The investments in the infrastructure for extracting this oil are currently being made. This stuff should be coming online fairly soon. And I'm wondering if this basically obviates the need to go into, quote-unquote, pristine Arctic areas where the dominant life form is a mosquito or drilling in coastal waters. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Wow, sounds like a whole lot of oil in North Dakota.
Well, there is. And we've known about this field for a long time. There's nothing new. It's not as if the Bakken field recently came to our attention. We've known about that oil for decades. The reason it hasn't been exploited is because it's awful expensive. It's very difficult to get at that crude oil. It's not a conventional field where you have a big pool of oil underground and you just drill a pipe down there and you get it out of the ground and send it to a refinery. It's dispersed through a lot of geologically difficult formations. And it's the main reason we haven't gone there. Prices have never been high enough to justify the investment. It would cost more to get the oil than you could sell it for on the market. Now, if prices in world markets today remain at the high levels they are, you're going to see more and more interest in those investments. And right now, oil companies are tentatively looking at extraction approaches there for Bakken. So Bakken may come online down the road, but it's not certain because it's very, very expensive oil to get out of the ground. And it's the unconventional crude oils I was mentioning a moment ago. It will be environmentally quite problematic. The amount of work and the footprint required and the industrial activity required to get that oil is far beyond anything that would be required in Alaska or off the coastal shores of the United States. And we can see hints of that sort of thing in Alberta today, where we're extracting a lot of tar sands. It's caused a great environmental mess. Environmentalists are not very happy with it. I'm much more agnostic about the question, but you have to acknowledge that these unconventional crudes, there's a lot of oil out there. It's expensive to get, but at current prices, it's probably profitable. The question is, are current prices long for this world? People in the oil industry aren't so sure about that. These are 30- or 40-year investments. They need to believe that these oil prices will be high for 30 or 40 years to make this investment worthwhile. And there's a lot of uncertainty about that. But even if they go ahead, then there's uncertainty about the environmental regulations associated with getting that oil. There's a lot of it out there, but there are a lot of uncertainties.
Tom in Madison, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to make mention, there's a company by the name of Changing World Technologies that has been manufacturing oil basically from carbon-based waste products for, I don't know, about half a decade now. Nobody's really talking about it. The guy initially was He's got two plants in operation, one prototype and one full scale, producing oil for about $8 a barrel, his cost. And you know, he put his plant next to, I believe it was a turkey processing plant, and they would just haul their dump trucks over, dump it in a hopper, and he'd get light crude oil and a couple of useful chemicals and pure water out of the process.
Yeah, and we're almost out of time. So, Jerry Taylor, do you know about this?
I'm not familiar with the company in question. I'm vaguely familiar with the technology. It turns out if there's economic merit to this sort of processing technology, believe me, investors are going to flock to it. You can make a lot of money in this world if you can produce oil for $8 and sell for $140. To believe that somehow the market is failing in this by leaving money on the table is to believe that a lot of greedy people with a lot of money are just stupid. They're not stupid. Where those investments make sense, they're going to occur endogenously in the market. We don't need government to do anything. We don't need to talk about it on radio shows. It's going to occur. Only when private investors with a lot of money at stake and a lot of greed at stake say no to investments over and over and over again, do we find people and lobbyists in Washington looking to promote, subsidize, or provide pilot programs for this or that. I don't think it's necessary. If these technologies make sense, believe me, sooner or later, probably sooner, market actors are going to take advantage of them because that's how you make profits.
Yeah,
you make a lot of profits right now with oil prices where they are if production costs are right, believe me.
Do you think Congress is going to lift the moratorium on offshore drilling or allow drilling in Alaska in our last 30 seconds?
You know, I don't know. I'm a think tank guy. I'm not a political pundit, but my guess is that they may, but they probably won't, because environmental lobbies are very well organized, and they have a disproportionate impact over people who aren't very well organized. Polls I've seen show that about 55 to 60% of the American public wants to see the moratorium lifted. They want to see more drilling. They want to see more supply in the market. But, you know, larger majorities of Americans believe a lot of things that the government is not about to do, like balance the budget. So we'll have to see.
Thank you so much for being with us.
You bet. Thanks for having me on your program.
Jerry Taylor, Senior Fellow at the Cato Institute. Thanks to Rob Ferret, Karen Prager, and Cynthia Schuster for producing The Hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network.